It's your last panel. Waste no energy on applause, for me, anyways. For our panelists, yes. Before we start our panel, we want to do one progress report, and that is from Ruth Messenger, who is president of the American Jewish World Services. And I also want to bring up what we always love in the Clean Global Initiative is when it builds. And Andrew Weiss has decided to make a major contribution to help them build on their efforts to support grassroots education in conflict areas and post-conflict areas targeting Darfur, Liberia, and Congo. For those of you who weren't here last year, our mega commitment, what you saw this year is on school feeding, school deworming, was on education and conflict. We had an enormous number of partnerships that committed over $150 million. We showed a lot of the videos on different ones to show you how much progress has actually been made. We want to give Ruth a couple of minutes to actually tell you about what's happened with the American Jewish World Service commitment.
Thank you, Gene. Thank all of you. I know you want to get to the panel. All of you are the experts on knowing the dimensions of the problems of education in the developing world, in the global south, in terms of numbers, in terms of access, in terms of malnutrition, in terms of all those other problems, teacher training. For those of you who don't know, just imagine how much worse it is in a conflict or a post-conflict zone. And so we are privileged, with Andrew Weiss's help, to be working in Sri Lanka, in Guatemala, and in Burma, on the Thai-Burma border, and in Darfur and Chad, to do this. And I'm only going to take the time, because it's going well, we're supporting about 14 different small grassroots NGOs. Two quick stories. In Darfur, in the city of El Fasher, there are at least 800 children who are orphaned by the genocide, who are simply roaming the streets. And we are providing them with education, but more important, perhaps, with recreation and psychosocial services that will allow them to get off the streets and come back into school. The other story is from one of the members of a consortium we support called the Mayan Alliance for Popular Education in Guatemala. The particular school is Fundación Nueva Española, but the most important thing is that this story is not in my words. This is from Rodrigo Iboy Alvarado, who is 17 years old, who attends the Instituto Nueva Esperanza, which is part of this alliance. And here's what he wrote. My community of Rio Negro has suffered too much. My parents suffered during the war, and my grandparents and many of my aunts and uncles died. Now, we want to have a better life, and we are studying hard to get there. I've been inspired to study by my big sister, Gloria Angelica, who is about to graduate as a schoolteacher. Now, my younger sister and I are trying to follow in her footsteps to become professionals and help our community. I plan to study nursing. Now I know how to study with more effort. I have a commitment to my family and my community. I hope my school continue supporting me to become a professional. I've come to realize that only by studying a lot can we get a good job and gain the skills to change things and make them better in our communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Please re-welcome our moderator, Mr. Gene Sperling. And welcome our panelists, Christiana A.M. Thorpe, Chief Electoral Commissioner and Chairperson of the National Electoral Commission. Zainab Salvi, President and Chief Executive Officer, Women for Women International. Wyclef Jean, Founder and Chairman, Yele Haiti.
You know, we always have innovations every year, and what we've seen in the education track this year is the innovation of a cheering group. And really, Wyclef, you know, Ruth was pretty competitive with you there. So probably only at the Clinton Global Initiative can an NGO head be competitive. But well, listen, I want to thank everybody. I do just want to say, you know, one or two opening words about education in conflict and emergencies. The reason why Clinton Global Initiative is focused on this, the reason why I personally have focused on this, and why myself and Angelina Jolie and others started the Education Partnership for Children of Conflict, is that education falls through the cracks for children of conflict. And it does so really for two or three basic reasons. One, when you're in often an emergency situation, people tend to think that all children need is water, security. Those things are absolutely crucial. But kids in conflict and emergencies tend to stay in conflict emergencies for a long time. They've been through unbelievable traumas. If they don't have the ability to go to school, they lose their futures. And yet, over and over again in conflict, education falls through the cracks. Then on the other hand, people don't want to give as much money to the governments because they're essentially often in conflict or post-conflict. That's understandable as well, because people want to make sure their money's going to be accounted for well. The problem is, if you let that reality exist, then you're basically deciding you have a public policy to let the most disadvantaged children dealing with the greatest trauma and hardship be denied an education. And that's why we try to put this focus on in each and every Clinton Global Initiative, to have a focus on education and conflict and emergency. This year, we're trying to do a little less just on if you're caught in conflict or refugee, but what it's like when you are dealing with how education fits into the larger struggle for peace and stability and overcoming emergencies. And we couldn't have a better panel to have this discussion. You know, on my left, Christina Thorpe is the chief electoral commission of the Sierra Leone National Electoral Commission. So we kept getting a little confused because on electoral reform, everyone said she is the best person, and on education, she was the best person. This is a remarkable woman. She was a founding chair and CEO of Sierra Leone's FAWE, which Kodu, who many of you met, is the executive director of, a former nun who left the church to devote herself to protection and education of girls, and a deputy minister of education in 1993. She established the emergency camp schools in the capital Freetown for children displaced by civil war. Our second panelist Zainab Salbi is the founder and president of Women for Women International. If you watch Oprah, and guys, it's okay. You can you can say like me, my wife TiVos it and just shows me parts I like. You've seen her many times. Her life is an amazing story. She grew up in Iraq. Her father was Saddam Hussein's pilot. It makes my dad's bio seem kind of boring. She's founded Women for Women in 1993, and they are comprehensive. They, like Wycliffe's, they do not focus solely on education, and I'll let her talk more about it, but education is a critical part of what they do. Women for Women International has impacted 5.3 million family and community members. They've helped 153,000 women survivors of war to rebuild their life. And it's the first women organization to ever receive the Conrad and Hilton Humanitarian Prize. Now, I don't know how to introduce the last panelist because there's a lot of controversy that has emerged at CGI over the pronunciation of his name. Yesterday, we had our press conference, and the president of the World Bank, Robert Zoellick, in what was a very painfully awkward moment, said, and I'd really like to thank Wycliffe. And we all cringed and thought, oh, geez, doesn't he know how to pronounce his name? At which point he came up and said, wow, that was the first time in 16 years an American has pronounced my name right. Since then, there's been a raging debate about whether he was just screwing with us when he said that, or whether Zoellick did. I, as you know, have economic policy background, so I'm kind of risk averse. So that I ensure that I don't completely screw it up, I'm going to introduce Wycliffe, or Wyclef Jean, founder of Yele Haiti, I'm not going to go through, you know, all the rock star stuff. You know, he thinks that's kind of self-evident by just seeing how cool he is. But he is here in his capacity as the founder of Yale Haiti. And I've said, this is so well regarded for its comprehensive, holistic approach for young people in Haiti. It's just another example we've seen of somebody who, despite doing well themselves, gives back and doesn't think it's okay to go forward with your life without thinking about how you give back to where you come from. And he has, their organization has really been a leader in Haiti, and now with the hurricane, their work and their challenge is even greater. So I thank our panelists very much. Let me just explain a little bit about our format. Because we added a special session with Tony Blair and others, this session was cut back some, but I think it's okay. Because what we're not going to have time to do is to do the normal session where you talk around the table, we get your questions and come up. But what we're actually going to have, because we only have really a little over an hour, is time to have actually a longer conversation here. What I would say is that if you have questions you would like me to ask, our folks will try to pick them up, and we can try to feed your questions in after the discussion's gone on for 20, 25 minutes. So we'll have that discussion with them. We will not have our normal table discussions just because we of the time crunch we're in. Now, I also have to say that this panel, by force of nature, did become a little less good-looking. George Stephanopoulos was supposed to moderate. Our initials are both GS. For all the years in the White House, President Clinton wrote an enormous number of notes that said 2GS/GS, and we'd argue which of our names had come first. George was making a heroic effort to get here this morning, and his 7:30 was canceled, and his 8 a.m. was canceled, and the 8:30 was delayed. So he is on a train. He will arrive, but not in time to moderate, but not out of lack of desire to get here. So with that, let me start this conversation. And Christina, I am gonna start with you. You know, we've been through a lot on education generally. You have a lot of people who are very knowledgeable of the overall challenges of reaching universal education in poorer countries. But tell us, what are the special challenges you see and you face when you are a country that is coming out of conflict and struggling to keep your democracy alive? What's different? What do people need to know that's different about the challenges you have faced?
Thank you, Gene. I think I'm talking to the converted here. But first of all, let me say, if you believe that educating a girl, you change a nation, I'm a living proof of that. I grew up in slum area where my sister and myself were the only two girls that had the opportunity to be sent to school. And as I was growing up, all my peers not going to school became a haunting something for me throughout life. And that gave me my passion for education. I finished school, I was a teacher, a principal, went, worked with the Ministry of Education, became a minister, and started an NGO for girls that are affected by war. And we literally lived and brought back nearly 6,000 to 8,000 girls that were sexually abused during the war. And it is no easy business, because when girls are abused, you know, first of all, they feel they are nothing. And I don't know if you're familiar with fish, and you know, I grew up the waters, and you know, when you have fish that has gone bad and you see the eyes sinking, that's what you see in the girls when they come back and they've been raped and they are bloody. And you have to give life to those girls. You meet girls like 11-year-old that are pregnant, and you have to get them through the pregnancy, see them through birth, teach them how to be mothers and how to love their babies. And this we did in during the war for about 5 years. I started my organization in 1995, and by 2002 we had worked with nearly 10,000 girls in country, and even when I was in exile, I too had to go into exile in Conakry, and we worked with those girls. And so the challenge for boys and girls, actually, who are affected by conflict, first of all, is to restore their dignity. And that dignity you restore by, no matter how you do it, some form of education. We, even when we had nothing under the trees, they will sit under the trees and use the sand and get them to draw out, or, you know, use their fingers to draw what has happened to them and begin to de-traumatize them, and you begin to counsel them. You need to get to where they are. And it is not easy, because it's as if you're drawing this thing out of a, when you have a snake bite and you are drawing the venom out, you actually sucking the venom out. You draw it out, but you get it yourself, and you have to be continually struggling to meet it. So I just link that with, when we come back, I'll tell you how, from that background, 3 years ago, I was asked to head the Electoral Commission, where we had 60% of the people of voting age now have gone through those 11 years of war, and they are going to vote. How did we get them? And because we are able to give them some form of education, we are able to get a peaceful transition of government from the incumbent to the new government, which is the opposition. So I listen to that.
I have so many questions for you, but I'm gonna try to get everybody in first and then come back. Zainab, you're in several countries in conflict, and you have focused very much as well on empowering women, often mothers, in these situations. Tell us a little bit, maybe a little bit about also what you're doing in Iraq, but generally, and where in your calculation of your more comprehensive approach, where does the education of women fit into this mix?
Well, actually, I was thinking today, I think I have been living and working in conflict for 30 years, and I'm not 30 years old, but I was 9 years old when the war in Iraq started, the Iran-Iraq war, and that was my first encounter in conflicts. And as you said, we, Women for Women International, work in different conflict areas, including Bosnia and Kosovo and Rwanda and Congo and Sudan and Iraq and Afghanistan. There are a few things about conflicts that I want to highlight. One is, when we talk about conflict, we often discuss only the frontline discussion, what you imply to, the fighting and the war and the military and all of that. And both as someone who lived in conflict as well as someone who worked mostly only in conflicts, there is what I call the other side of war. There is how do people live on a day-to-day basis, which we sort of don't talk about it at all in our daily coverage of different conflicts. Most of the time, 90% of the time, you actually have some sort of stability in a very unstable circumstances, i.e. there are still bombs and there are still fighting and suicide attackers and all of these things, but you actually still have to run your life as in, I have to eat breakfast, lunch, dinner, and what do I do in my daily life? So that we need to understand, that no matter what the war is, even if you're a refugee, there may be instabilities of months, sometimes weeks, sometimes a day, where everything stops. But most of the times, that life needs to continue. So how do you address, how can we address education, particularly with schools, in the midst of that? One of the things that is what Chrissy, you mentioned, there's numbness in the kids' face in refugee camps. There's just like there's nothing to do, and there is this numbness. So whether refugee camps or whether you're actually living in it, how do you continue to go to school? Second, and how do you live life normally? And we need to pay attention to that normal life in the midst of war. Second is security. Now, everyone understands that education is actually very important. I was in Iraq a few months ago, and one Iraqi woman, she said, if we don't have education, how can we have democracy? How can we talk about good democracy if there are no educated people in the country, which they aren't at this point? And so security, a lot of people stop their kids from going to school because of the security. give you a very personal example. My cousin stopped taking his kids to school because he said every time I'm driving my daughter to school, it's like going through a war zone. There is this checkpoint and there is this suicide bombing and there's all of these things. So he stopped sending his daughter to school. And this is an educated, college-educated person saying it's her life or the school, and I'm just going to take her out of school and bring her tutors. And in his case, he can afford doing homeschooling. But how can we address that whole issue of stopping to go to school because the schools are being targeted for bombing? One Iraqi woman that I met a few months ago was going to college, 18 years old, going to college, her first month in college. And in the way there, there was a man who shot the car driver that she had and shot her. And she's paralyzed from the neck down. And she's like, I'm just a kid who wanted to go to college. So her parents stopped all of their other children from going to school or college. So there is this security reality of how do we then look into other alternatives. Is education important in the midst of war? You bet. We did a survey of Kosovar women. 93% said education is one of the most important thing, but 63% of them said that we do not have educational resources. According to Save the Children, there was 1.1% of all emergency aid that was sent in crisis situations in 2006. Only 1.1% was sent towards education. So there is very little resources sent. It's like what you're saying. We send aid thinking that we're packing for camping. What do we need? Emergency food, some good clothing. But if you're living in the midst of crisis, you really need something that keeps your life going. So how can we address these realities and alternative realities? Everyone thinks that the problem or the solution for education is build schools. Well, the bricks and mortars is good as a good start. But really, we need to address both the women and their children's reality in terms of what's their economic reality, why are they not sending their kids to school, what is the teachers, no one is talking about the teachers' salaries, how little it is, the resource, skills. There is so many components in the midst of war that we can address. It's feasible. We have done it in many different ways, but we just need to look into the more complex reality that war presents and how do you become creative and sort of under bypassing the collapse of the infrastructure and delivering services in a very informal way just to keep education going. In Iraq, for example, you have a very, very common thing to see women in their 40s and even their 30s who are literate and maybe very well educated primary school or high school graduate, but their kids are illiterate. And it's actually fascinating for me. It's a reversal of a generation. You know, it's when I was growing up, it was illegal not to send your child to school. You could go to prison. Right now, most of them are not sending their kids to school, both for security reasons and for economic reasons. One woman told me, if I can't get a job and I'm literate and I don't have any money at this point, I can't afford to send that, you know, my daughter to school for that penny I have. And when I don't know if she will get a job because of that. So I'll stop there and for the later discussion.
Well, thank you. And it's actually a good jumping off, Bart, because as you know, President Clinton kind of challenged all of us at the beginning of the CGI to think what extra we could do for him to announce in the final session on Haiti because of this remarkable way that they were hurt so badly by the hurricane. And yet, it got virtually no attention. Even Matt Damon and Wyclef, however, you know, could not together really break through the U.S. media that was focused on the election, the destruction in Texas. And that's a very big issue. But I think that, you know, the truth was we invited Wyclef to speak here long before that happened because, you know, I had, at President Clinton's request, had gone down to Haiti to meet with the president and others and had learned a lot about his NGO at that time. And when I looked at his NGO there, I thought this is an NGO that is in its own way dealing with children of conflict and with one of the toughest, most poor, in many ways, school systems in the Western Hemisphere. So, Wyclef, I thought maybe you could start by kind of talking about the overall challenges your organization has always sought to address, and then maybe just give us a sense about how that's gotten even harder with the hurricane.
Thank you, Gene. And in America, it is Wyclef, but the actual spelling is Wyclef. So you could call me whatever you want. You call me Jean, I'll call you Jean, though. All right? If you hear my voice is a little hoarse, it's because last night I was in a jam session with the Buffets till like 5 in the morning. The best way to explain it to you is starting with myself. I was born in Haiti till I was 10 years old. I'm from a small village which is called Le Cerf outside of Port-au-Prince. My father, I didn't know who my dad was. He left me at the age of 1 year old, came to America on a work visa. He was a Nazarene minister of Christian faith. And the reason why he left Haiti is because of political instability. And he wanted a better life for the family, and they was trying to kill him, his brother, and et cetera. What I remember about growing up in Haiti, I used to go to school on a donkey half of the time. And the other half of the time, we basically used to walk for miles. In school, we had the gift of memorization, which means you look at the book, you have to memorize your lesson. You have a certain amount of time to memorize the lesson. If you don't, they're going to pull out a whip, and they're going to whip you. So 9 times out of 10, I used to get a beating. No, I'm kidding. I used to always memorize my lesson. It was very important. Then we would go back home. When we would get back home, when there was no food, I remember going to the backyard, to the front yard, and taking dirt. It was called red dirt, and actually eating the dirt, supplementing the dirt for food. So in this small village, we always hear about a place called America, you know? And in the village, the tale is like, when you go to America, you will be rich. There will be diamonds coming from the sky, and everybody is rich in America. So I'm looking at my little brother. I'm like, man, we got to get to America. You know what I mean? Because this village ain't cutting it, man. So, but keep in mind, the village is a hut. There's absolutely no electricity. I don't really know what light is. The only light that I was aware of till 10 years old is basically the light that comes from the sun. And we would look at the sky and we would see the planes. The planes were so far, we didn't know that they were planes. We used to call them giant birds. I had another gift. I was good with a slingshot. So sometimes when we were hungry, we'd take slingshots and go knock birds from the sky, and this is how we ate. The reason why I tell you that is for you to understand that, you know, I am part of what I am talking about, which I think is the most important thing. When you're speaking about education, you have to understand the psychologics of the kids that you're basically dealing with. The NGO Yele Haiti, which we started, was started in 1997 with the Fugees. But what took it off, I was in Paris on tour, and I get a call, and they said that Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the president of Haiti, has just got ousted from Haiti, and that there's a kid on the phone. He's responsible for 30,000 soldiers that are in a place called Cité Soleil, and they all have Uzis, and they're basically like, yo, we're not putting down our guns till we talk to Wyclef. So I don't know why they want to talk to me, though, but I'm on tour in Paris, and I get the call, and he's speaking Creole to me, and he's like, yo, Clef, listen, man, we got these guns. We're not putting them down. We'll go against whoever unless you tell us to put our guns down because we trust you. We know if you tell us to put our guns down that you will do something for us. We hear your music. We believe in you. I went to Haiti 2 weeks later with my cousin Jerry, went to a place called Cité Soleil, and then we went to a place which was called Bel Air. Bel Air was copying what they saw in Iraq. The kids were wearing ski masks. They had their guns, and then they had a bunch of small little soldiers walking around that were kids. What they would do is they would beheading guys, and the kids were taking the heads and parading through the village to have shown that the gang leader had died. We get into Bel Air. We go inside of the gang area. When we get in there, all the kids are completely with ski masks on. I say, I want to talk to the leader. Now imagine the scene. I'm with my cousin Jerry Wonder. He gets nervous because no one's taking off the ski mask. So he offers one of the gang members a cigarette, you know? And the guy takes the cigarette, then he takes his mask off and starts to smoke. So then Jerry goes, cigarettes for everybody, right? So now everyone starts to smoke. But when I sit there and the gang leader's in front of me, just to conclude what I'm saying, they all sitting in front of me, and I say, what's the problem? One guy speaks up. He says, look, Clef, I was a teacher, and now I have no job. I have five kids I want to send to school. What do you want me to do? The other guy says, look, I was an architect. Here's my plans, showing me his plans. He says, what do you want me to do? Another kid is 17 years old, says, Clef, look, 70% of the population is less than 21 years old. And we have no jobs, there's no schools. 95% of the people have to pay to go to school in Haiti, in the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. So this is what we have to question and we have to ask ourselves. Are we just going to be another NGO for show? And then after the CGI, say bye. Sounds like a song, right? Or are we actually going to do something? That's what I like to say.
Well, let me go back a little. Christina, I'm going to ask you a very specific question, and I think it goes to, you know, I think it's one of the most difficult problems, and I think everybody's addressed it to some level. But let me ask you on the solutions part. Around the world, people are trying to get their 6- and 7-year-olds to, you know, poor places to go to school. But we all know when you come out of conflict, this story is everywhere. The adolescents who are experienced at war. And guess what, everybody? If you do have a parent who are a 6- or 7-year-old, you're not really very excited about having them sit in school with a 15-year-old who's carried a gun and killed several people. So what's the strategy? How do you reach the adolescent? What's the educational strategy for dealing with that adolescent who's either been so wounded or so experienced in violence? How do you integrate them when they may actually need to go to 2nd or 3rd grade?
You meet them, first of all, at their level, meaning whether in the marketplace. In fact, you have to meet them out of educational, you know, sectors. And then as if they are boys or girls, or you know, then you begin to talk to them and let them tell you what they are interested in. You see, there has to be alternative forms of education. A girl or a boy that's 15 or 16 years that has missed out on schooling, you can't go and start to teach him ABC and 1, 2, 3. That's not his interest. You need to know what is their interest. And you zoom into those interests and use functional education in that capacity. If a boy is interested in riding motorbikes or interested in masonry or carpentry, you need to find those areas for jobs. Because, you know, as teenagers, they can't go to school, they don't work, they don't have any source of income, so they become fodder for drugs, for stealing, for others to use, and I wear in my election cap here, for the political parties to use, abuse, and misuse them, just for that short time. So you need to zoom into them, boys and girls, and get them moving. Once you have that, then functional literacy, if it's a motorbike, as I say, if it's carpentry, get them to be trained into carpentry. And as they are training, they begin to learn what's a table, how do you spell a table, this is a table, and they see it there and then. And as you move along, you have to have the job at the end. For example, in Sierra Leone now, during the war, the rebels systematically used school materials for firewood. At the end of the war, There was no bench, chair, or table in any school. And we still have schools that children have to stand up or stoop, you know, stoop to read or write. So we have thousands of these young people. Get them into carpentry. While they are learning the trade, you can put the furniture back into the schools, and they'll be earning a living, and they'll feel themselves responsible.
Gotcha. Thank you. Zainab, you took us inside Iraq. You're one of the few organizations that is actually working on the ground with the mothers and women living day by day in conflict. Take us outside of Iraq now. Take us to more your work in a post-conflict situation, which we would hope Iraq would be in soon. But in a post-conflict situation, what's been the strategies for you and best in trying to the strategies or the greatest obstacles you face in getting children back into school or back into learning within their family structure when you're in that post-conflict situation?
Well, I'll describe our program, and through each component of the program also describe the situation we're facing and the challenges. The first program that we have is an appeal for every single woman and man to sponsor one woman. Now, we call them women, but we work also with women as young as 13, 15, 16, 18, above. They are women in their circumstances. They are either mothers of their own children or they are heads of households, and the treatment, they need to be treated as women because of their situation, at least their circumstances. So we call it women and young women, but it goes all the way to adult ages as well. And we ask each person in here to sponsor one woman at a time by sending her $27 a month along with a letter to start communication link between the two of you. One of the things I call war is like a flashlight on humanity. It shows you the worst acts of humanity, but it also shows you the best acts of humanity. It's always a story of that stranger who helped me, whether it is your neighbor or whether it's someone you don't know or whether it's someone from a different country, a Mary somewhere, helped me by sending me some money and some letter and saying, I'm here for you. So that's one of the things that we appeal is just to keep people's belief in humanity. I mean, if challenge number one is I hear people saying we used to believe in the concepts of women's rights and human rights and children's rights, but when our rights were violated and no one did anything about it, we no longer believe in that. So challenge number one is to restore the belief, as simple as that, and hope. And that's what we try to do through our letters exchange and the monetary support. Then once the women get into the program, they are grouped in a classroom of 20 other women. We call it a women's circle, and they go through two kinds of training. One is educational training in women's role in economy, society, politics, and health, so with different detailed components of all of that. And in that, and this is the challenge, is you're dealing with trauma. So I was in Rwanda a few months ago, and I met a young woman. She's 18 years old, and she said, I was 8 when the Hutus killed my father in front of me. And I hated them since then. I could not speak with them. I would not sell to them. I would not buy to them. I would not anything and nothing. She is the head of her own household, so of her own siblings, as well as she is a mother of her own child. She comes to our program, and the teacher in her classroom is a Hutu woman. And the first 3 months, she said, I did not say a word. I hated that woman. How could I be in a classroom where the teacher is a Hutu and they are the killers of my father? But I needed the support, so I stayed. And I met her in her graduation. She stood up in front of about 200 women saying, I no longer hate. I love now. This very woman of the ethnic group that I thought were trying to kill my father and my family helped me and saved me, and I am I'm actually back to my life, running my life in a better way because of her. So you're dealing with issues of trauma, and how do you replace really notions of hate with hope and love? I mean, and it's not goofy for me to replace that. These are real issues people hate when you see your parents getting killed in front of you, and we need to deal, when we talk about education, we need to talk about these issues of how do you replace hate with love. The third component of our program, which is training, they need jobs, as you said. they really need jobs. Well, no matter if she's 18 or she is 16 or she is 20 or 30. And so we do market assessments and we try to see what is the local economy spending their money on, what are the poor people spending their money on, and so, and the middle class and the elite, whatever is left in that, in these post-conflicts. And so, you know, we teach anywhere from tile making in Congo, because everyone is restructuring their, reconstructing their home in the midst of conflicts, to, for a while we did coffin making because it's a good business, frankly, you know, so it's carpentry teaching, but to jewelry making and farming and all of these initiatives that really gets them jobs with not, you know, it's, on the side income, with tangible good income where this young woman can stand on her feet. And that's how we measure our success, is how can we help her? The challenge with that is plenty. It's skills. How can we give her, like, what I call basic business skills? Attend the meeting on time. You know, have a very good, have a competitive price for your product. It's really basic business skills. And how can we give her tangible solutions? It's not just to train her and set her off there, but really give her a job. Microcredit is one of the solutions, but the fact of the matter is not everyone is an entrepreneur, as been discussed in the session. So how can we really, either through cooperatives or through jobs that we are creating, small factories, small business initiatives where we are creating jobs for her. And that's the second challenge in midst of war, is that you try to create some kind of an economy in a very unstable thing, a situation. But it's possible. And we've done it in so many different countries that I believe, I absolutely believe it's possible.
Thank you. And Wycliffe, it's like you you told a story. You got right up to the dramatic. People had taken their ski masks off. I guess everybody wants to know now, so what do you do? What do you do? You have those. You have the ski masks off. What is the strategy of Yele Haiti to strengthen education, realizing the enormous challenge you just described even before the hurricane?
Okay, you know, I'm from Brooklyn, so when somebody walk in the room, I got to give them a shout out first. Shout out to Matt Damon in the house. What up, baby? I see you, baby. this is how it works for us at Yele. The ski mask comes off. Now that the ski mask comes off, we have a sense of trust. Now what we have to do is what's called follow through. Follow through don't mean starting a program for 6 months and it don't stay sustainable. So you have to make the program sustainable. So I will take you through one program so you understand. Let's go to the children prison program, for example. Over 181 kids in prison went to Haiti at the time with Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, visited the prison. These kids are what the gangs use. We go in there, I take over the prison. We say, let's bring education in the prison. Let's bring health care inside of this prison. Let's start to teach these kids in this prison. This is the first step. Now, the reason why we did that is because once we came in there the first time, after we left before the program started, 11 of the kids, they let them out to prison, and they went back to the gangs, and the gangs killed them for talking. So now back to the prison system. So we said that we can't only teach them inside of the prison. What are they going to do when they get out the prison? Which is the most important thing, the continuation and making every project sustainable. So the way that we do it is we teach them inside of the prison. And then after they're done, now there's a halfway house so that once the kid is finished in the prison, he has an education, he gets out. He doesn't have to go back to the streets. He goes straight to the halfway house. Now, in terms of education, you can have as much sexy schools as you want, but you're going to have a problem when you ask a teacher what's 1 plus 1, and she tells you 16. See, the problem is that it starts off with you have to train the teachers. The teachers are the key to training the kids. So within a program, we could renovate as much schools as we want. But unless we start with these teachers, and so Yele Haiti, we believe in going and training teachers, then the teachers start to train the students. Now, for example, if you go to a school And you can use natural things of the earth. For example, math, for example. Bring the kids out to the back and take like 7 rocks and put them on the floor. Take 3 rocks away. Say, how many rocks are there? So this is what Yele believes in, actually using what's actually in the country to make it work. So this is how we've been effective in what we do, because it completely has to be sustainable. It can't start and stop. It has to start and continue.
Thank you. In our remaining time, and I don't want to turn this into a pledging call, but I think that it would be interesting, I think, for a lot of people here to know, if you had an extra $1,000, and if you had an extra $100,000, with all the things you're doing, what would you apply it to? What would you do if somebody wanted to contribute, or if you had this money? What would be the most important thing that you would do, or how could somebody make a difference at those different levels of contribution in the struggles that you're trying to overcome? I'll let you go first, Christina.
Jean, since I wear 2 hats, I will make 2. Yes. With regard to elections, and you may or may not have heard that for the 2007 in Africa, Sierra Leone had the best elections, transforming, getting the opposition in, because that's what the people said. What we did, and because of my background in working with these adolescents who had not been to school and out of war, a year before elections, we got in touch with these adolescent boys and girls. 8,066 of them, we gave a 4-month program in just the basic electoral process, what it means to go into voter education, voter registration, delimitation. And Mondays to Thursdays, 3 hours a week, they were trained in that. At the weekends, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, each one of them had to go and train their peers, who are their peers who have never been to school, in the local languages. And this is where I merged the two, in that my organization, the women who are in each district in the country, we are asked to monitor these informal weekend classes. And at the end, we had 86,000 young people between the ages of 18 and 35 ready for the elections. Now, what we did when it came to recruiting staff for the elections, for like where you ask them to guide the voters, make the lines, we recruited all of these ones. They were so involved in the process, they were so anxious, that when the politicians came during campaign time to get them, to give them drugs, to give them whatever, to disrupt things, they met with a bleak wall, because these young people now have a purpose. So to answer your question, in the next 3 years, I would take every year 10,000 out of school boys and girls, go through that process with them, and get them to tuition their partners, their non-school going colleagues, and prepare for 2012 elections. The reason why, you may or may not know that after conflict, the elections immediately after conflict usually go well, because the UN is there, all these international people are there, and everything is there. When it comes to the second round, where you turn over to locals, where the security is on the local police and the local army, there you begin to have problems. So we have surpassed that one. We've got over that. Now the third one will be the proof. Are we really ready for democracy? And if we can, in 3 years, train 30,000 young people who can also now train 10 times that, ready for 2012 elections, I could say 2012, Sierra Leone would be the most democratic country in the world. So.
All right. I'm already planning our 2012 progress report when you come back as head of state and tell us how it went.
Possible.
Zainab, do you want to give us an idea of you've told us a little bit, but I want to give you a shot to answer the question as well.
Well, if this was Oprah, I'm going to pretend that you're Oprah Winfrey, I would ask everyone here to sponsor a woman for $27 a month for a year. That's very, very simple. But it's not Oprah, it's CGI. So for $27,000 a month, or $270,000, or $27 million, you can do a lot of things. One is... we have a very strong educational component. One of the things that we're trying to do with it is not only expand it, but also leapfrog through the technology gap. So we want to actually do literacy through computers. There are such programs. We want to introduce it to the women that we are working in. And we do that in Afghanistan and as well as in all the countries that we're working in, DRC, Congo, Southern Sudan, Nigeria, Rwanda, among other countries. I was in Afghanistan last year, and one young woman wrote, Afghan women did not know anything before, and now we know things now that we're going through this education program. And her friend corrected her. She said, we always knew what we wanted. This is just the first time that we can express it. And what we ask for money is to help them express what they want, and this is what we are about. And then last but not least is solid economic opportunities. There are a few people here. Lauren Bush here has included the products that are made by Women for Women, Internationalist Women, in her designs. Kate Spade is ordering products from our women in Bosnia, and we're always looking actually for businesses to invest in these countries. We'll guarantee quality, we'll guarantee everything, but we're really looking for businesses to invest. As like Muhammad Yunus said this morning, it's not only philanthropy, we're looking for investments, and we know through CGI the best investment is in women. It's a solid investment with a solid return, not only for you, but for their societies and the world.
Thank you. And Wycliffe, as we said, the president will talk later about what people can do, especially for the hurricane. But how can people help on the overall challenge, the immense challenge that you're already dealing with?
2 seconds about the hurricane. Haiti got struck with four hurricanes back to back. And the immediate aid which is needed that we feel is to start. The schools of Gonaive, for example, right now, there was 22 schools that we was part of renovating. So what we want to do is renovate those schools immediately. And in those schools, we want to put computer labs. That's the immediate thing that we want to start renovating schools in Gonaive immediately so that the kids can start going back to school, which is very important. The overall idea for Yele Haiti, which we feel can carry it and make it sustainable for the next 100 years, is basically what is called a Yele Center in Port-au-Prince. The Yele Center will consist of the Wyclef Jean School of the Arts, which will be very sexy. It will consist of computer labs. It will consist of a proper stadium, a proper gymnasium. It will consist of every programs that we have in Yele. We put it in one area. Now, what we do is we work with America and the international community, start an exchange program where students could study abroad as long as they come back to their country like Wyclef Jean did and make a change. So definitely you could go up on the website, yele.org. And my daddy always told me, he passed away, when you in a room with billions of dollars, don't ask for millions. So I need billions from y'all.
Am not a billionaire, not sexy, not a rock star, but there's one thing I observe just as a fan, which is when you're throwing a concert, have a good finale. And when we planned CGI, we knew that this was going to be the most inspiring panel and that we wanted to end on that. I really got to thank the three of you. I could listen to you for a long time, and it makes me want to be a billionaire so that I could help you. It really does. So I really want to say from the bottom of my heart, and I say this to others, you all are just my heroes, and I'm just so inspired, and thank you so much. Thank you. But everybody else cannot leave yet. You can leave. You can sit down. But we have to do, if we can just do, I know it's been a long process, and we're just a few minutes away from being done, but we're just going to do a very couple of quick progress reports and a couple of quick certificates. And, you know, Wyclef, somebody, they may want a picture more of with you than me. I don't know why. But let me quickly just bring John Wood, who is the founder and CEO of Room to Read and an inspiration himself, to give a quick progress report on their very, very dramatic commitment from last year. John?
Thanks, Dean. Thanks. What happened to the whole cheering section notion? That was kind of lame. Thank you. I mean, how the hell is a guy going to follow that? That's kind of like, you know, Woody Allen said, never put a comedian on after another comedian, and now I feel like, wow, I'm now up here. So I'll be very brief. I can't talk as fast as Ruth Messenger does, but I can definitely try. Last year at the Clinton Global Initiative, thanks to Gene and thanks to Justin, Room to Read made a commitment. It was a commitment that completely and totally terrified me. Gene has been a mentor to me. He's been a great guy to work with. Last year, he came to my office in San Francisco. I think he was at least 3.5 hours late. Kept getting calls saying he was on the way. We ended up talking for about 2 hours. And he said, how's Room to Read doing? You're in your eighth year. What's going on? And I started telling him about how wonderful things were, that the girls' scholarship program was expanding to over 4,000 girls, that our school program was expanding. We were expecting to have 750 schools open by the end of 2008, that our library program was expanding. And I said, Gene, I'm so happy because this year we're going to open 1,600 bilingual school libraries. That literally is 4 libraries a day. That is literally 1 library every 6 hours. And by the end of this year, we're going to have opened 5,160 libraries in the poorest parts of the world. And Gene looked at me and he said, that's good. That's not really good enough. There's huge need out there. There's literally millions of communities without libraries. There's tens of millions of kids without access to books. There are 800 million people in the developing world who are illiterate. 2/3 of them are girls and women. There are dozens of countries that need this. So you need to think big and you need to think bigger. So tell me how you can leverage CGI. I talked to my team. We made a commitment last year on one of these stages that we would double our number of libraries from 5,000 to 10,000 by 2010. It took us 8 years to do our first 5,000, so in kind of like a Moore's Law fashion, I'm an ex-Microsoft guy, we decided we'd do the next 5,000 in 3 years. We would double the number of local language children's books we produce using local authors and local artists, books like Tommy Tempo in Nepalese, books like Baby Fish Goes to School in Sri Lanka. These are all books that are culturally relevant and have a very female-friendly theme. Books like Baby Fish Go to School are all about gender equality in education, getting baby fish to actually go to school. And we committed to growing to new geographies, places like South Africa, Zambia, and Bangladesh, where there's a huge need for programs for education, for literacy, and for books. We committed that we would basically build this network out and reach 5 million children with our library program by the end of 2010. I'm happy to report very quickly on progress. Why did it scare me? Because we didn't have $25 million. My commitment was to get my butt on the road and fundraise $25 million. To Wycliffe's point, don't talk, act. So I've been going all around the world, from Dubai to New York to London to Tokyo, to raise money. We've received support from this campaign from Scholastic, which has committed over 1 million English language books to us, donated 1 million books to augment our local language books. Cathay Pacific gave us a one-time use of a 777-300 extended range jet to fly those books over to Cambodia. That was a very fun flight. We did run out of champagne, but that was not a huge problem. And we received support from Goldman Sachs, from Credit Suisse, from Qualcomm, from Barclays Capital, from JP Morgan, from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, from Salesforce.com, from Microsoft, from the Financial Times, from Scott Mead, who's here today, who's doing his commitment to Room to Read. We received a $1 million commitment from somebody I met last year at CGI, and we will soon announce a very exciting partnership with Dubai Cares under the amazing leadership of Her Excellency Reem Al-Hashimi, who is here at CGI. We'll be announcing something with them next week or next month. So we're currently at $20 million we've raised. When we hit $22.5 million, one of our funders is going to trigger a $2.5 million donation that'll take us to $25 million. So we have to basically hit that this year. And we're excited about that. It shows that at CGI there are no guarantees. There are not always the people in the audience who will come up to you and say, where have you been all my life? Here's the blank check I came to CGI with. But it shows you can use it as a platform to think big and to then think bigger and then to go out and excite the world with your vision. And Gene's taught me a lot about that. In closing, I want to announce that we've actually are going to up our commitment. Based upon where we are, based upon this challenge grant I have, and I think we're going to hit it, we're upping our commitment from 10,000 libraries by the end of 2010 to 12,000 bilingual village libraries that will serve boys and girls. We will reach at least 5 million kids. We are upping our commitment in total. And this is, again, a fundraising commitment, but I've got a lot of energy. We're upping our commitment to $50 million by the end of 2010. And with that, I'm getting my butt back on the road to fundraise. Thank you very much, and thank you, Gene.
John Wood was a stock I would buy and hold for a long time. I believe in him. You can see why. We have one more progress report from Dawn Haig Thomas, and this is another great kind of partnership where the GSMA Development Fund bringing technology and connectivity not just to the easy places but to the refugee camps. I want to have her come up and give you a very brief progress report to give a sense of what they've been able to do.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. This time last year, the Development Fund at the GSMA, which is the Global Trade Association for Mobile Phone Operators, made a commitment together with the UNHCR, Ericsson, and MTN, who are one of the big mobile phone operators in Africa, to prove that it was possible to build affordable and sustainable mobile communications for refugees. So as you're probably aware of the figures, there's 10 million refugees today, 24 million internally displaced people around the world, and typically they have little or no communication in the areas that they live in. So a month after CGI, I went out to Uganda with my team, and we went and spoke to people in the refugee camps to understand what they wanted, what they needed, and understand the price points that people could afford. So we're building new businesses. And we heard stories of people earning a dollar a day, saving their money, to then spend $7 on a bus fare into Kampala, to spend $5 an hour on internet access, $7 back to the camp, because that is how important communications were to them. So a classic case of people paying a poverty penalty. So we set to work on our project, and I'm pleased to announce that we're now live with two internet cafes in refugee camps in northern Uganda, Moyo and Adjumani. We've also got 40 individuals who are Grameen phone style village phone ladies who loan out their phones to the community. And the response has been fantastic. We might have some photos up. Some photos recently taken in the last month from the centres. Big queues for the services to get onto the internet. And of course, people are using this for educational purposes, also for social, like you and I. Football scores are being checked for sure. But also people are writing CVs, they're applying for jobs internationally, and most importantly, they're being able to connect with the global economy and the global world and have some hope for their future. So in terms of where next with our commitment, we've now got a framework. We've proved that it's technically and commercially feasible to connect some of the poorest communities in the world through business means. And one of the big demands was, of course, northern Uganda. Where do people want to send their emails to? They want to send them to southern Sudan. They want to send them to Juba. So that's where our project moves next.
Thank you. And thank you for bringing the pictures, too. It's been one of the great things we've done this year, I think, is to let people see with their own eyes what's being promised. We just so much want to recognize what everyone does. We've kind of innovated the shout-out just so we can at least, because we can't fit everybody. We've had such a great response. So I'm giving one shout I have to give is to Debbie Berger. If you're out there, to stand up, Debbie. Because Debbie played an important role. She was one of our two initial funders, her and Jamie Cooperhan, in getting the Education Partnership for Children of Conflict started. And they're now extending their commitment to the Women's Commission and Jenny Perlman Robinson, to the INEE, which is the Network for Education and Emergencies, which we've been talking about, and to the International Rescue Committee to build in University of Nairobi a center of excellence on education and emergencies. So thank you very much for your leadership in that area and continuing commitment. And another shout out to the Alliance to End Hunger, Max Finberg. Yesterday we announced a mega commitment on school feeding that brought together key players from across sectors in all regions of the world. Max was a huge help in making that happen. And next spring, he will kick off the community of practice on school feeding and connecting practitioners in the field with government officials of homegrown school feeding programs across sub-Saharan Africa. And I also want to do a shout out to Karen Moroz, who is here helping out with our theme team and is a founder of Grace Lola. Their commitment is to expand their holistic after-school program that includes nutritious meals to victims of conflict across the West Bank and other areas of conflict in the Mideast. Thank you, Karen, for both being part of our work here, but also for your commitment. And we always love moments like Barry and Dolly Siegel, just after they heard Marita Roots speak yesterday, just stepped right up and offered $25,000 on the spot to train 10 new entrepreneurs in 1-year program in South Africa. And that may seem like a... in the millions and billions, that may not seem like a huge amount, but for those 25 young people, that is a huge change in their life. So thank you so much. And then Zainab, we got to bring you back on stage because she's doing a commitment to train 100 female survivors of war as homeschool educators for young children to educate at least 100 Iraqi children. So that is a commitment for Women Internationals, together with the Jolie Pitt Foundation, who gave this as part of a commitment, as part of a $1 million commitment they gave to help children who were victims of Iraq, half in the United States, children who had lost their parents, but also half of the children in Iraq. It's a way of saying that there's only our children in war. There's not there, and there's no separation. So, Zainab, you want to just step right up?
Thank you.
And then I wanted to announce Stephen Cohn and Margaret Cohn, founder of the Interfaith Leadership Program. If they can come up. And I just have to say, this is a program that the President Clinton really wanted us to push, because I have to be honest, one of the things when we did the education commitment, when we had an education panel, one of the things that lost out was we had a panel before, a track on ethnic conflict. And one of the things President Clinton asked us very much was that in each of our panels to be trying to do what we can in this area. And this is such a neat commitment. What Margaret and Steve are proposing here is to create the Interfaith Leadership Program to develop of the next generation of religious leaders from the U.S. and the Mideast. And what they're doing is engaging leaders in debates on issues related to history and democracy, playing a larger role in international exchanges. The focus on future leaders from the very different faiths in the part of the world where is the greatest conflict. I think at every table when we've looked at things, a lot of the comments have been, well, what do you do to prevent the conflict in the first place? And so I love this commitment because that's really what this is about. So thank you very much. Thank you. And then Tom Arnold, another one of our key partners on the Education Partnership for Children of Conflict. They're just everywhere doing great things. And their commitment, Tom, are you here? Got to be quick. Tom's commitment is to concerns commitment. If I can find your card right now that I've done this. Is to improve access and quality of primary education for about 520,000 children in 10 conflict-affected countries, involving parents and community members, doing the school health connections, and ensuring communities have adequate schools, furnished classrooms, providing teachers resources in an effort to keep teachers motivated and education quality high. And I think one of the interesting things is that for those of us as individuals, we may do our contribution by giving for books or training a teacher, but when you see your organization, when you see Wycliffe's, when you see Zainab's, they're being holistic, and you see that over and over again, and thank you so much for your commitment. Now, if you guys want to try to get those pictures with, you know, Wycliffe or Matt, if he's still here, good luck, and if you could stay, in case they are so fortunate. One thing we got asked was we had three individuals who I think just, you know, really touched a lot of us. Valentino Acek Deng, who, of course, spoke last year. Valentino, are you here? Valentino, stand up. Grace, who is not here, but was the female child soldier. The reason she's not here is because she just didn't want to miss any more school. And I thought, you know, it was hard for me to argue with that. But she was the woman who really brought to us not that it's not just the boys in ski masks who are child soldiers, but the girls, and they have their own special challenges. And again, her, just like Valentino, they, at the same time they're overcoming trying to get their education, they all three of the people mentioned are creating a foundation to build a school for back in the village where they came from. And then Kakenya, is Kakenya here? Kakenya started our dinner off Tuesday night by telling her inspirational story of overcoming unbelievable barriers, unthinkable barriers to now be in a place to get her PhD in education, University of Pittsburgh next year. And I know, and listen, you know, I haven't had a friend yet who got their PhD on time, so don't be embarrassed if, you know, you can come back in 2010. It's okay. What we tried to do in creating the Education Partnership for Children of Conflict was to make it very easy to give. So we have put up on www.educationpartnership.org, www.educationpartnership.org, each of their organizations. You go right there and you can give. And I'm not a wealthy guy, I'm a policy guy, but let me start by giving $500 to each of your groups and encourage anybody else who in a small way would like to help these three very, very remarkable young people build their schools. All right. Well, you know what? I'm going to, you know, I think everybody here gives in their own way and in their own time and space. And I really wanted to mention these three people because I just think they move so many people, and I just had several people ask. And we want to get you used to going to educationpartnership.org because that's just what Angeline Jolie and those of us together have set up is not about raising funds for a new NGO, but being a way of promoting and giving money to NGOs like that who could use the profile and make it easy to give. Let me just do the quick thank yous. Jackie McLemore from America Speaks and Christine, help you. Thank you so much, America Speaks, for helping keep on time. And Arthur, the voice of God. Arthur, can you come behind the screen and take a bow?
Thank you, Gene.
You know you were running long when the voice of God started getting a little lippy with me a couple of times. All of our table facilitators, thank you so much. Nicole Golden, who was our CGI commitment manager. And then you know, everybody who is on my team, they're all doing this part-time. Several of the people work with me at the Council on Foreign Relations. They do this on top of everything they're doing. I just want to thank Lauren Smith for her help so much. Unbelievable late nights. Colleen Bouchain, she's kind of our alumni, came back from London. We flew her in just so she could see if she could still handle 3 hours of sleep a night. Gabrielle Apollon, see, Gabrielle can't lose us. She came on as a volunteer intern over the summer. Then we kept, got her going. Then she's from Haiti. And we said, oh, you've got to be part of this. And so, Gabrielle, thank you so much. You're stuck with us. You can never escape. But we'll let you try to get your degree at Columbia while you're helping us. Anda Adams is my right-hand person at the Council on Foreign Relations. She's the greatest multitasker in history. She does so much great policy work, and you know, we made her do a little emergency event management here as well. Michelle Jolin and I go way back. Michelle Jolin is a true social entrepreneur from Ashoka and from the White House and doing everything right now, but she's still here as one of my absolute key deputies and partner. Victoria Palomo, if I ever was on time, if I ever did look together at any point, if anything ever went well, it was Victoria's, to her credit. And her only lesson here is that when you have no cards for me, you have to actually bring three copies before in an hour, because I may still need that third copy by the time I get up. Robin Sturm graduated from Yale Law School. She could have done anything she wanted this summer. She could have worked for any firm, any place, and she dedicated herself to one thing, making that school feeding and school dewarming Megan commitment the success it was. So thank you so much. And all contributions are valued, but, you know, there's always one person, usually, who you just, you couldn't survive without. And Justin Van Fleet, Justin, stand up. Justin worked so hard last year that he seriously was hospitalized and couldn't come. And even though we got Shakira to give him a call in the hospital, we thought that was pretty good, he was heartbroken not to be here. We sent a limousine, and him and his mom came just so he could see 2 hours of what he had worked on. This year, he worked around the clock. He is, you know, my main man, my co-partner on this whole thing. I would not be standing. This would not have gone nearly as well. And it started with the amazing opening lunch that we had. Those 12 videos that were created when people told us that wouldn't work and Justin just stayed at it to bring to life, that was amazing. That was a tribute to all the groups, but to Justin, I just cannot thank you enough. You know, education, it's not about us. It's the joy of working as my I've had a lot of old powerful bosses. One of them was Mario Cuomo, and he said there is nothing like the power of working together with people of like mind on something that is bigger than yourself. And when I left the White House, I knew my life was probably not going to be as glitzy. There wasn't going to be as many Air Force One rides, but I knew that there would be nothing like waking up every day and working on a cause that you knew mattered so deeply, so that no matter how much you're in the weeds, when you're working on the details that seem boring to others, et cetera, you know the lives that will change. And to see the amazing people who are on the ground doing work, to see the amazing young people like Kakenya and Grace and Valentino, I'm so inspired, but I am so humbled. I feel so unworthy of what they do. I can't say anymore. I'm just honored to be in your presence. Thank you all for coming to the Education Track.